Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Horror Night at Radio Revolt. And today we're going to have a nice little chat about death and what happens afterwards. Mostly what happens afterwards.
And before.
Yes, and before, well...
We know what happens before death. It's the after part that's funny.
Yes, it's interesting because, well, we don't know shit about it, really.
No, we don't. And who are we?
Perhaps we should introduce ourselves. That's a nice thing. Maybe we should do that. We should think a little while about it.
Who are you? Do you know it?
No, I have no idea. Who are you then?
I think I'm Trum.
Oh, bugger.
Yeah, I know.
I might be Hans then.
Yeah, you might be Hans. You look like Hans.
Then I probably am Hans. That might be.
Unless you're a zombie. That's very fresh and looks like Hans.
Right. A zombie of me would, of course, be very talkative, so it might be the case.
Oh. So you might be, what do you call it, Dracula?
No. I might just be a usual zombie and I will... I'll stop that there, or else I'll start insulting people.
Yeah, I think we'll perhaps do that. But right. Today's radio broadcast going to concentrate on zombies and the undead in different types and flavors.
Yeah, mostly the undead in, various types and flavors, as you said. But first, we're going to have a little look at death. Close-up look at death, I'd say.
Yeah.
It's a nice little piece by Gertrude Atheron.
Yeah.
Atheron something. Anyhow, she was born in San Francisco in 1857. She had a quite usual life until she was married at
19,
yes. Yeah. Had two kids. And then her son died of one disease or the other. And then her husband perished at sea. And
that of course, very terrible. Child dying, but...
But she could then pursue writing.
Yeah, which she couldn't do before because, well, you weren't supposed to write when you were a woman.
No, so she wrote in the pseudonym of Frank Lynn. And actually, as a protege of Ambrose Bierce.
Yeah.
She ended up writing almost 60 books. Sorry. Numerous articles and short stories.
Yeah. Bierce, we have, of course, talked about previously, and he's a great writer that we like quite a lot.
We mentioned him a few times, and his work, The Devil's Dictionary.
Yeah.
It's an amazing thing.
But Gertrude, her writing is quite detailed, actually. It's very, very nice detail.
I've been in touch with the writing such as these before. They almost cross over into the stream of consciousness genre, if you'd call it that, or mode of writing. But it isn't. It isn't sentences that is about half a mile long. Let's say, half a mile. Just a page, then. Just one page, one sentence. That's Virginia Woolf. But this is quite nicely told, and it's a nice little piece. I think we should just hear it.
And the Woman by Gertrude Atheron. Her husband was dying, and she was alone with him. Nothing could exceed the desolation of her surroundings. She and the man who was going from her were in the third floor back of a New York boarding house. It was summer, and the other boarders were in the country. All the servants except the cook had been dismissed, and she, when not working, slept profoundly on the fifth floor. The landlady also was out of town on a brief holiday. The window was open to admit the thick, unstirring air. No sound rose from the row of long, narrow yards, nor from the tall, deep houses annexed. The latter deadened the rattle of the streets. At intervals, the distant, elevated lumbered protestingly along, its grunts and screams muffled by the hot suspended ocean. She sat there, plunged in the profoundest grief that can come to the human soul. For in all other agony hope flickers, however forlornly. She gazed, dully at the unconscious breathing form of the man who had been friend and companion and lover during 5 years of youth, too vigorous and hopeful to be warped by uneven fortune. It was wasted by disease. The face was shrunken, the night garment hung loosely about a body which had never been disfigured by flesh, but had been muscular with exercise and full-blooded with health. She was glad that the body was changed, glad that its beauty, too, had gone some otherwhere than into the coffin. She had loved his hands as apart from himself, loved their strong, warm magnetism. They lay limp and yellow on the quilt. She knew that they were already cold and that moisture was gathering on them. For a moment, something convulsed within her. They had gone, too. She repeated the words twice, and after them, forever. And the while, the sweetness of their pressure came back to her. She leaned suddenly over him. He was in there still, somewhere. Where? If he had not ceased to breathe, the ego, the soul, the personality, was still in the sodden clay which had been shaped to give it speech. Why? Why could it not manifest itself to her? Was it still conscious in there, unable to project itself through the disintegrating matter, which was the only medium its creator had vouchsafed it? Did it struggle there, seeing her agony, sharing it, longing for the complete disintegration which had put an end to its torment? She called his name. She even shook him slightly, mad, to tear the body apart and find her mate. Yet even in that tortured moment, realizing that violence would hasten his going, the dying man took no notice of her, and she opened his gown and put her cheek to his heart, calling him again. There had never been more perfect union. How could the bond still be so strong if he were not at the other end of it? He was there, her other part. Until dead, he must be living. There was no intermediate state. Why should he be as entombed and unresponding as if the screws were in the lid? But the faintly beating heart did not quicken beneath her lips. She extended her arms suddenly, describing eccentric lines above, about him, rapidly opening and closing her hands as if to clutch some escaping object, then sprang to her feet and went to the window. She feared insanity. She had asked to be left alone with her dying husband, and she did not wish to lose her reason and shriek a crowd of people about her. The green plots in the yards were not apparent, she noticed. Something heavy like a pall rested upon them. Then she understood that the day was over and that night was coming. She returned swiftly to the bedside, wondering if she had remained away hours or seconds, and if he were dead. His face was still discernible, and death had not relaxed it. She laid her own against it, then withdrew it with shuddering flesh, her teeth smiting each other as if an icy wind had passed. She let herself fall back in the chair, clasping her hands against her heart, watching with expanding eyes the white sculptured face, which in the gathering dark was becoming less defined of outline. Did she light the gas, it would draw mosquitoes, and she could not shut from him the little air he must be mechanically grateful for. And she did not want to see the opening eye, the falling jaw. Her vision became so fixed that at length she saw nothing, and closed her eyes and waited for the moisture to rise and relieve the strain. When she opened them, his face had disappeared. The humid waves above the housetops put out even the light of the stars, and the night was come. Fearfully, she approached her ear to his lips. He still breathed. She made a motion to kiss him, then threw herself back in a quiver of agony. They were not the lips she had known, and she would have nothing less. His breathing was so faint that in her half-reclining position she could not hear it, could not be aware at the moment of his death. She extended her arms resolutely and laid her hand on his heart. Not only must she feel his going, but so strong had been the comradeship between them, it was a matter of loving honour to stand by him to the last. She sat there in the hot, heavy night, pressing her hand hard against the ebbing heart of the unseen and awaited death. Suddenly, an odd fancy possessed her. Where was death? Why was he tarrying? Who was detaining him? From what quarter would he come? He was taking his leisure, drawing near with footsteps as measured as those of men keeping time to a funeral march. By a wayward deflection, she thought of the slow music that was always turned on in the theatre when the heroine was about to appear, or something eventful to happen. She had always thought that sort of thing ridiculous and inartistic. So had he. She drew her brows together angrily, wondering at her levity, and pressed her relaxed palm against the heart it kept guard over. For a moment the sweat stood on her face, and then the pent-up breath burst forth from her lungs. He still lived. Once more the fancy wantoned above the stunned heart. Death. Where was he? What a curious experience, to be sitting alone in a big house. She knew the cook had stolen out, waiting for death to come and snatch her husband from her. No, he would not snatch. He would steal upon his prey as noiselessly as the approach of sin to innocence, an invisible, unfair, sneaking enemy with whom no man's strength could grapple. If he would only come like a man and take his chances like a man. Women had been known to reach the hearts of giants with the dagger's point. But he would creep upon her. She gave an exclamation of horror. Something was creeping over the windowsill. Her limbs palsied, but she struggled to her feet and looked back, her eyes dragged about against her own volition. Two small green stars glared menacingly at her, just above the sill. Then the cat possessing them leaped downwards, and the stars disappeared. She realized that she was horribly frightened. Is it possible? She thought. Am I afraid of death, and of death that has not yet come? I've always been rather a brave woman. He used to call me heroic. But then with him it was impossible to fear anything. And I begged them to leave me alone with him as the last of earthly boons. Oh, shame. But she was still quaking as she resumed her seat and laid her hand again on his heart. She wished that she had asked Mary to sit outside the door. There was no bell in the room. To call would be worse than desecrating the house of God, and she would not leave him for one moment, to return and find him dead, gone alone. Her knees smote each other. It was idle to deny it. She was in a state of unreasoning terror. Her eyes rolled apprehensively about. She wondered if she should see it when it came, wondered how far off it was now. Not very far. The heart was barely pulsing. She had heard of the power of the corpse to drive brave men to frenzy, and had wondered, having no morbid horror of the dead. But this, to wait and wait and wait, perhaps for hours past the midnight, on to the small hours, while that awful, determined, leisurely something stole nearer and nearer. She bent to him who had been her protector with a spasm of anger. Where was the indomitable spirit that had held her all these years with such strong and loving clasp? How could he leave her? How could he desert her? Her head fell back and moved restlessly against the cushion, moaning with the agony of loss. She recalled him as he had been. Then fear once more took possession of her, and she sat erect, rigid, breathless, awaiting the approach of death. Suddenly, far down in the house on the first floor, her strained hearing took note of a sound, a wary, muffled sound, as if someone were creeping up the stair, fearful of being heard. Slowly, it seemed to count 100 between the laying down of each foot. She gave a hysterical gasp. Where was the slow music? Her face, her body were wet, as if a wave of death sweat had broken over them. There was a stiff feeling at the roots of her hair. She wondered if it were really standing erect, but she could not raise her hands to ascertain. Possibly it was only the colouring matter freezing and bleaching. Her muscles were flabby, her nerves twitched helplessly. She knew that it was death who was coming to her through the silent, deserted house, knew that it was the sensitive ear of her intelligence that heard him, not the dull, coarse-grained ear of the body. He toiled up the stairs painfully, as if he were old and tired with much work. But how could he afford to loiter, with all the work he had to do? Every minute, every second he must be in demand, to hook his cold, hard finger about a soul struggling to escape from its putrefying tenement. But probably he had his emissaries, his minions, for only those worthy of the honour did he come in person. He reached the first landing and crept like a cat down the hall to the next stair, then crawled slowly up as before. Light as the footfalls were, they were squarely planted, unfaltering, slow. They never halted. Mechanically she pressed her jerking hand closer against the heart. Its beats were almost done. They would finish, she calculated, just as those footfalls paused beside the bed. She was no longer a human being. She was an intelligence and an ear. Not a sound came from without. Even the elevated appeared to be temporarily off duty. But inside the big, quiet house, that footfall was waxing louder, louder, until iron feet crashed on iron stairs and echo thundered. She had counted the steps. 1, 2, 3... Irritated beyond endurance at the long, deliberate pauses between. As they climbed and clanged with slow precision, she continued to count audibly with equal precision, noting their hollow reverberation. How many steps had the stair? She wished she knew. No need. The colossal trampling announced the lessening distance in an increasing volume of sound not to be misunderstood. It turned the curve, it reached the landing, it advanced slowly down the hall. It paused before her door. Then knuckles of iron shook the frail panels. Her nerveless tongue gave no invitation. The knocking became more imperious. The very walls vibrated. The handle turned swiftly and firmly. With a wild, instinctive movement, she flung herself into the arms of her husband. When Mary opened the door and entered the room, she found a dead woman lying across a dead man.
Thank you. Extra good news. The makers of Jell-O have discovered a way to give you rich, luscious chocolate pudding far more easily and far more economically than ever before. With the new Jell-O chocolate pudding powder, you can make old-fashioned pudding, smooth, creamy, and chocolatey, just like the ones grandmother used to make back in the good old days. Now you can have them again, and this is all you have to do. Just combine the contents of a package of Jell-O chocolate pudding with some milk in the top of your double boiler, letting it cook until it becomes smooth and thick. When the mixture has cooled, serve it in sherbet glasses. You'll have enough for 6 helpings. And that means 6 happy people. Jell-O chocolate pudding is so simple, so inexpensive, and so downright delicious that you mustn't delay trying it. Ask your grocer for Jell-O chocolate pudding, and if he hasn't put it in stock yet, be sure he orders it for you. Remember the name, Jell-O chocolate pudding.
Jell-O chocolate pudding. Jell-O chocolate. Right. Pudding? Sorry.
What? Pudding?
Pudding! Mm. I want pudding.
Chocolate.
Mm. Chocolate and pudding. Yes, that's the thought.
I think we are a bit easy to sidetrack, actually.
Oh, you do?
Yeah, I think
we are. What makes you think that?
I think chocolate has something to do with it. I don't really know.
Chocolate is delicious. Chocolate is awesome. I really want chocolate now. Maybe I should make chocolate when I'm...
The question you perhaps have to ask yourself is, would there be a big difference if we were zombies than what we are now?
Well, the difference between brain and chocolate, really. That would be the main difference.
Brain. That doesn't ring the same tone. Though the sound of it is good, but in my heart, I must say chocolate
before brains. Yes, chocolate is a lot better. I mean, brains is squishy, gray thing that people... Well, actually, they don't used to think. That's the main problem, maybe.
Yeah.
So maybe everyone else is zombies. Yeah.
Yeah. Dying.
Yes, dying is a nasty business. It's generally... It probably will hurt a lot. At least if you go in a violent way.
Yeah. Have you thought about it yourself? Thoughts about dying?
It ends. Period. Nothing.
So when it stops, it just...
Black, nothing else.
Yeah.
Well, if it were black, and I would have a sense of time, it would be hell. I mean, Imagine all eternity with nothing, absolute nothing.
Yeah, only thoughts like, did I remember to turn off the gas stove?
Or even better, can I turn on the light? Is there anything going on here? Hey, is there anyone there? Apparently not.
Yeah. So, but are you afraid of becoming undead?
I must say that the general fear of becoming undead hasn't really crossed my mind yet. It's not something I really think about. If it happens, it happens. Yeah. Probably.
I'm a bit more, old school that way. I'm
conservative.
For instance, I don't want to travel overseas with ship because...
You mentioned that.
If I die... on a ship over the Atlantic, for instance, and they will just throw my corpse over the side of the boat because, of course, they can't take me with them for 20 days on a boat.
It'll stink.
Yeah, that'll stink. So they just throw me over edge, and then I will become a Norwegian draug.
Nice.
Yeah. Person that's that's deceased and aren't buried in...
Sanctified
soil. So that's something I have to just remember, and therefore I don't take boats unless I really, really have to.
Or unless they're short trips.
Yeah, really short trips, because then it's not a problem.
Indeed. It didn't cross my mind like that.
No, that's very... But
in a way, it could be kind of cool to become a lich. Then you could just sit and brood in your library all day, read all the books you want for all eternity. But then on the other hand, your body is decaying. It's gonna suck.
Yeah, but that's what we're doing now, isn't it?
We're just, yes, we are.
We're sitting in a library right now and just talk about what we would do if we had another millennia to do just the same.
Yes, and we both know that we would do exactly the same thing. I mean, it wouldn't change one bit, which means that we actually like our lives, I suppose. Or that we are creatures of extreme habit.
Yeah, I think we are. Remember last week, just taking the little trip with the train?
Yeah.
You know me, it took me all day to reconcile with the thought of actually leaving Trondheim town for a couple of hours.
Actually, it's lying. It took 2 days.
Yeah, okay. But zombies.
Yeah, zombies. I had to know more about this phenomenon because it's a rather new thing, you know. So I went up to the source of incredible knowledge and where you can find answers to absolutely everything. No, it's not the library, it's the university. They have a library. So
multiple libraries, actually.
Oh, they have multiple. Okay, right. They have more than one library. Therefore, they are the source of, as I said. And I met a crazy Dane, actually. The guy somehow lives here. Why he wants to move from Denmark? Well, not all that hard to imagine. But anyhow, we talked a little bit about zombies. I had thought that I should actually ask him some questions, but after a while it came apparent that he actually talked on his own accord. So, well, here you go.
My name is Jesper Petersen, and I'm a PhD in religious studies.
Wonderful. And you know a few things about zombies.
Yeah, well, I've been interested in zombies for a while now, mainly because the zombie is a fantastic and beautiful creature of the night, something
isn't
very
vampires.
That's true. The zombie can exist a day in sunlight with no harm done. But the zombie is a fantastic creature, mainly because the zombie has a very complicated history, which is fascinating for me as a historian of religions in this case, and is a beautiful example of how people use culture to create new culture.
Yeah. So, the history of the zombie.
The history of the zombie. Well, that's a complicated thing to do briefly. But
why?
Yeah. The zombie in modern culture is a complicated phenomenon with a very rich history. You can differentiate between at least two types of zombies.
Mm-hmm.
The zombie slave of Caribbean culture and the modern undead of horror movies. And the two zombies are interrelated, but at the same time very distinct figures. And you have to understand, of course, that the word zombie is connected to African culture through that Haitian Caribbean genealogy. But on the one hand, we have the slave zombie. And that zombie is not necessarily dead, actually. It's generally connected to black magic. It's connected to wider syncretisms and creolizations of African tribal religions and Catholicism and the social context of being a slave, being transported from your homeland and stuff like that. But it's actually, if you look at that culture, it's a minor part of Caribbean culture. But the colonial imagination took that zombie and the voodoo culture because that was strange, exotic, terrifying, both to the people who lived there and desperately tried to be separate from the primitive, barbarous hordes of Negroes drumming and dancing in the night, as well as tribal diseases trying to kill them off. So both to these people who lived there and to the ethnographers and cartographers and measurers of various kinds coming from the empire to count or examine these colonies, the zombie and voodoo culture was a thing you could easily see as the other and easily magnify and use to illustrate to the Western readership that the Negro was in fact childlike or primitive or closer to animals, because that primitive culture was in essence something less civilized than, than the white colonial thought. So the zombie and voodoo in general, the Haitian zombie, existed at least from the late 18th century as a colonial imagination, as a topic in the colonial imagination. Mm-hmm. And actually, from the very beginning, the zombie was connected to stories the writers heard about mysterious powders or some scientific rational explanation of things. But at the same time, it was connected to the tum-tum poundings in the night, you know, the horrible religious aspect. So it was a complicated figure, even in the colonial imagination. Yeah. But the major point was to illustrate that disease and animal-like behavior was prevalent in the barbarous hordes that couldn't be civilized. But then, and that's the second stage in this disembedding process of the zombie, then this story suddenly starts to change, and that's something that happens in the early 20th century. Mainly because of William Seabrook and his stories about the zombie, or about Haiti in the magical island. Because the zombie all of a sudden started to be sensationalized, in a sense, and got disembedded from the colonial imagination and started to move towards a more tabloid or sensational imagination. It was still connected, of course, to tom-tom poundings in the night and Negro barbarism, but at the same time, it took on this aura of horror and fright, and started being imported into mainland American culture in this case, and became combined with, you know, a general imagination of something rising from the grave.
Yeah.
And then in a complicated process, this figure of the zombie, this semi Haitian and semi sensational undead, was combined with horror stories in the 20s and 30s, mainly Lovecraft, of course, and Herbert West, Reanimator.
Obviously.
Yeah. And then we had something that was entirely different. I mean, Lovecraft didn't use the word zombie, but it was obvious that his, or Herbert West's, experiments with dead and rising of the dead, which is sort of a modern horrified Frankenstein story, becomes combined with this general interest or fear of the dead, the dead rising from their graves. And this figure lived in American imagination and in Hollywood films, with films such as White Zombie and Revenge of the Zombie, lived a life that was, well, it was there, but it was kind of semi-dead until the 60s, where George Romero, with his Night of the Living Dead and later Dawn of the Dead, totally disembedded the zombie from any connection with the Negro past, and all of a sudden made it this generic being of some kind of natural or supernatural event, a result of this some kind of event that made people rise from their graves. And he in a sense presented this new type of horror zombie, often a rotting being, blue or green, and often missing limbs, or at least and the meat cleaver.
Of course.
And this being became a staple of horror movies in since his work, but of course the imagination continued, and in the 80s the the beautiful brains, attractions, strange attractions to brains, and the necessity of vocalizing this need all the time, what was put into the zombie template.
Yeah.
And then in the 90s and after the millennium, in the new millennium, we all of a sudden got this amplification of the humorous and ironical aspects of the zombie that we have today, where we can actually go back and play being a zombie, just like we play being a vampire. And yeah. And in this sense, the zombie all of a sudden became something we could use actively to comment on our own life and on life in the Western society in general. So it's a very interesting figure here.
But the zombie in modern horror culture.
Yeah.
Zombies always use a more comical aspect, as for instance, supposed word, vampire.
Yeah.
Which is tragic and...
Except in Buffy.
Oh, yeah, except in Buffy, but that's an exception.
But that's true, but in a sense, you have to see comic in a dual perspective.
Yeah.
Because on the one hand, I agree that the zombie has a comic or ironical aspect to it that can be, on the one hand, just good, clean fun. There's a lot of them, and you can just kill them off, and you can make zombies with funny hats or coming from funny places. Something that George Romero actually did. He had the very famous Hare Krishna zombie in Dawn of the Dead. A beautiful comment on both Hare Krishna, his comment on Hare Krishna, but also a beautiful example of why take just zombies and make them all look alike? Why not make them all different? And you can just comment on the society that you live in. So on the one hand, it's just good, clean fun. You can make fun with and through the zombie. That's one thing, but there's another aspect of the comic zombie, and that is, I think of that in a more genre, conventional way, whereas the tragic story of the vampire is connected to hopelessness, and often connected to some elitist fantasies of being alone in the dark, combating the need for blood or the need for something. Then the zombie, in a sense, it's connected to hope, and in this sense is a comical figure. And I mean, you can see the zombie narrative from two angles. From the survivor's angle, as the true survivor story, and that is obviously one of the the beauties of Romero's Night of the Living Dead, his first zombie movie, because that was the point, the claustrophobic paranoia of being trapped inside a house and trying to protect yourself from the zombie hordes. Mm-hmm. And ironically, of course, being shot in the end by rednecks, because you survived, but you got killed anyways. That was a beautiful comic. But, and he continues that with being trapped inside the shopping mall in Dawn of the Dead, and continue that actually by being trapped inside a city and so on. So the survivor story, that's an important aspect. And that is, in a sense, comic. Not that you laugh, but in the sense that you retain hope.
Mm.
And the stories are built on some kind of continuation of hope. And that is perhaps most obvious in the crazy subgenre of zombie movies today, mm-hmm. that often keep the original horror of the Living Dead. And you can see that in 28 Days Later, the newest version of I Am Legend with Will Smith. Movies that are discussing a global pandemic of some weird disease that transforms people and makes them homicidal. And I understand that some people really need to differentiate these zombies from the regular undead zombie, but I can see that this type of zombie movie or crazy movie is a good example of this type of comic narrative. The hope narrative.
Yeah.
Whereas the Shaun of the Dead and the other true comic movies, they are survivor movies in a different sense.
Yeah.
And actually, they are perhaps a borderline example of another type of comical use of the zombie, and that is the modern day use of the zombie in zombie culture. I mean, the way you're dressing like a zombie, dancing with other zombies in zombie parties, the zombie walks all around the globe. These are examples of perhaps embracing the zombie as the grand collective of the dead. And then the horrifying conformity of being dead in the survivor story becomes the beautiful way of being dead together, but also different from mainstream society that desperately tries not to be dead, in a sense. So then it becomes a comment on conformity and what is perhaps a terrifying thought that is being dead and just interested in brains, and that is the ultimate conformity, in a sense, becomes a beautiful subculture or counterculture to mainstream conformity that is... worse, even though it's because perhaps it tries to survive, then it's worse because it is obvious that the zombie will win out in the end. So that's a different kind of hope, in a sense, that you become part of a grand collective of zombie dead.
Has the war created new problems for you in your marriage?
You worked too hard, you ate too much, the cheesecake made you greedy. Let your aching head and stomach hear this message from Old Speedy. Alka-Seltzer, plop, plop, fizz, fizz, oh, what a relief it is. Plop, plop, fizz, fizz, oh, what a relief it is. Ah, those Speedy Alka-Seltzer bubbles burst into action to relieve your upset stomach and aching head fast. It was only as directed. Oh, what a relief it is. What a relief.
Right, then we know a few things more about a zombie, and we have a cure for some weird thing or the other.
Yes.
Yes.
But zombies, a very interesting topic.
Yes, the undead in general is a very interesting topic. In fact, our dear Bram Stoker considered to use another title than Dracula for his, rather famous novel.
Yeah.
From 97. He considered to call it The Undead.
Oh, that's okay. That's okay. That
yes, you can imagine Dracula as a shambling corpse walking around in his manor house eating brains. And no.
And also the other way around. Think about if every zombie was a bit like Dracula. Like, yeah.
Yeah, I can imagine the teeth.
Yeah.
The two front teeth sticking out. The fancy 1800-ish suit. Clothings,
yeah, it's like, oh yeah, everyone turned emo. That's nice.
No, everyone turned goth, and that's worse.
Yeah. No, but it's interesting. But the name Undead, we use it for a lot of different flavors of, well...
Dead things that are not behaving very dead-y.
Yeah.
Yes, we use them, yes, for instance, the zombie, which you now know a lot about. Come on, bloody papers. The Jianxi, the Chinese variant of the zombie, they are look like the zombie and behaving like the vampire in a way, except they're not intelligent at all.
Ghoul?
The ghoul, yes, which may or may not be dead, actually.
Yeah, can different be versions.
Different versions. In Lovecraft, they aren't dead. In some other authors, in Arabian folklore, they are demons.
Mm.
It actually literally means demon, ghoul.
Mm. Every country or every society has its own dead kind of creature.
Yes, it has its own dead creature, and it has its own blood drinker.
Yeah.
That's actually quite interesting.
Also, yep. In Norway, where we are now, we have a creature called Draugen.
Yes, Draugen.
Draugen. And,
Draugen.
And he is the... He's a creature spawned from a dead fisherman that has been lost at sea.
Mm.
And he, when you see him, it's a sign of coming death.
And general darkness and despair and all those things.
Yeah.
So yes, he is in fact quite similar to the ferryman, I believe. He's called the German chap.
Yeah.
Basically the same thing. Oh, well, it's ferryman from the ferryman to over the river Strix and all those things.
And in more modern version, you have the Lich.
The Lich, yes. It's in fantasy fiction, mostly, not in horror fiction.
But what is the point about the Lich?
The point about the Lich is that the Lich has created itself. It's made itself undead. It's an act of something to achieve immortality.
Hmm.
To continue its intellectual work or something. Usually it's a wizard or a king that wants to continue to reign forever or to... conducting experiments on the still living, breathing things until the end of the earth.
Hmm.
Yeah, not to be
that wouldn't be so bad, actually.
They are zombies with intellect, basically. Yeah. It wouldn't be all that bad. Sitting in a library, reading all the books I want, listening to the music I want.
Mm. Yeah, but that's more or less what we're doing right now.
Yes,
sitting in a library and talking with the people that I want to talk to. And
exactly. And the interesting part about our thing is that we don't get any replies. We can talk all we want and no one will ever complain.
No. So, but that's perhaps a good place to stop our, not our broadcast, but the part where we talk in it.
Yes.
This is, of course, a podcast. You have found it on the internet, so you can find it again. And
hopefully.
You can check us out on Radio Revolt. .no/horrornight. Perhaps
yep.
You should take it in, say it one more time in English so they can understand
it. Yes, Radio Revolt in one word .no/horrornight in one word.
Yeah. And this broadcast is, of course, under Creative Commons license. And,
yep. And everything that you're hearing here of. Goddamn, I forgot the word. All the red things, the things that we are talking about, it means the Conclave of Corpses, which we'll listen to soon, and the...
And the other short story we had at the beginning. Yeah.
Yes, they are found at LibriVox.
Yeah, so you can check them out there.
Yep.
And but we are going to hear a little piece now.
Called the Conclave of Corpses. It's a Scottish folk story, you could say.
Mm.
We don't know who's written it, because it's so bloody old.
But it's quite okay, actually.
Yes, it's rather nice. Good night, and have a nice time with the Conclave of Corpses.
The Conclave of Corpses, anonymous. Some 300 years since, when the convent of Kreuzberg was in its glory, one of the monks who dwelt therein, wishing to ascertain something of the hereafter of those whose bodies lay all undecayed in the cemetery, visited it alone in the dead of night, for the purpose of prosecuting his inquiries on that fearful subject. As he opened the trapdoor of the vault, a light burst from below, but, deeming it to be only the lamp of the sacristan, the monk drew back and awaited his departure, concealed behind the high altar. The sacristan emerged not, however, from the opening, and the monk, tired of waiting, approached and finally descended the rugged steps which led into the dreary depths. No sooner had he set foot on the lowermost stair than the well-known scene underwent a complete transformation in his eyes. He had long been accustomed to visit the vault, and whenever the sacristan went thither, he was almost sure to be with him. He therefore knew every part of it, as well as he did the interior of his own narrow cell, and the arrangement of its contents was perfectly familiar to his eyes. What, then, was his horror to perceive that this arrangement, which even but that morning had come under his observation as usual, was altogether altered, and a new and wonderful one substituted in its stead. A dim, lurid light pervaded the desolate abode of darkness, and it just sufficed to give to his view a sight of the most singular description. On each side of him the dead but imperishable bodies of the long-buried brothers of the convent sat erect in their lidless coffins, their cold, starry eyes glaring at him with lifeless rigidity, their withered fingers locked together on their breasts, their stiffened limbs motionless and still. It was a sight to petrify the stoutest heart, and the monks quailed before it, though he was a philosopher and a skeptic to boot. At the upper end of the vault, at a rude table formed of a decayed coffin or something which once served the same purpose, sat three monks. They were the oldest courses in the charnel house, for the inquisitive brother knew their faces well, and the cadaverous hue of their cheeks seemed still more cadaverous in the dim light shed upon them, while their hollow eyes gave forth what looked to him like flashes of flame. A large book lay open before one of them, and the others bent over the rotten table as if in intense pain or in deep and fixed attention. No word was said, no sound was heard. The vault was as silent as the grave, its awful tenants still as statues. Fain would the curious monk have receded from this horrible place, fain would he have retraced his steps and sought again his cell, fain would he have shut his eyes to the fearful scene, but he could not stir from the spot. He felt rooted there, and, though he once succeeded in turning his eyes to the entrance of the vault, to his infinite surprise and dismay, he could not discover where it lay, nor perceive any possible means of exit. He stood thus for some time. At length, the aged monk at the table beckoned him to advance. With slow, tottering steps, he made his way to the group, and at length stood in front of the table while the other monks raised their heads and glanced at him with a fixed, lifeless look that froze the current of his blood. He knew not what to do. His senses were fast forsaking him. Heaven seemed to have deserted him for his incredulity. In this moment of doubt and fear, he bethought him of a prayer, and, as he proceeded, he felt himself becoming possessed of a confidence he had before unknown. He looked on the book before him. It was a large volume bound in black and clasped with bands of gold, with fastenings of the same metal. It was inscribed at the top of each page, Liber Obedienti. He could read no further. He then looked first in the eyes of him before whom it lay open, and then in those of his fellows. He finally glanced around the vault on the corpses who filled every visible coffin in its dark and spacious womb. Speech came to him, and resolution to use it. He addressed himself to the awful beings in whose presence he stood, in the words of one having authority with them. Pax vobis. 'Twas thus he spake. Peace be to ye. Hic nulla pax, replied an ancient monk in a hollow, tremulous tone, baring his breast the while. Here is no peace. He pointed to his bosom as he spoke, and the monk, casting his eye upon it, beheld his heart within, surrounded by living fire, which seemed to feed on it, but not consume it. He turned away in affright, but ceased not to prosecute his inquiries. Pax vobis, in nomine Domini, he spake again. Peace be to ye, in the name of the Lord. Hic non pax, the hollow and heart-rending tone of the ancient monk who sat at the right of the table were heard to answer. On glancing at the bared bosom of this hapless being, also the same sight was exhibited. The heart, surrounded by a devouring flame, but still remaining fresh and unconsumed under its operation. Once more the monk turned away and addressed the aged man in the center. Pax vobis, in nomine Domini, he proceeded. At these words the being to whom they were addressed raised his head, put forward his hand, and, closing the book with a loud clap, said, Speak on. It is yours to ask, and mine to answer. The monk felt reassured, and his courage rose with the occasion. Who are ye? He inquired. Who may ye be? We know not, was the answer. Alas, we know not. We know not, we know not, echoed in melancholy tones the denizens of the vault. What do ye here? Pursued the querist. We await the last day, the day of the last judgment. Alas for us, woe, 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 resounded on all sides. The monk was appalled, but still he proceeded. What did ye to deserve such doom as this? What may your crime be that deserves such dole and sorrow? As he asked the question, the earth shook under him, and a crowd of skeletons uprose from a range of graves which yawned suddenly at his feet. These are our victims, answered the old monk. They suffered at our hands. We suffer now, while they are at peace, and we shall suffer. For how long? Asked the monk. Forever and ever, was the answer. Forever and ever, forever and ever, died along the vault. May God have mercy on us, was all the monk could exclaim. The skeletons vanished, the graves closing over them. The aged men disappeared from his view, the bodies fell back in their coffins, the light fled, and the den of death was once more enveloped in its usual darkness. On the monk's revival, he found himself lying at the foot of the altar. The gray dawn of a spring morning was visible, and he was fain to retire to his cell as secretly as he could, for fear he should be discovered. From thenceforth he eschewed vain philosophy, says the legend, and devoting his time to the pursuit of true knowledge and the extension of the power, greatness, and glory of the Church, died in the odor of sanctity and was buried in that holy vault where his body is still visible. Requiescat in pace.